This is Paul McGann.
The Eighth Doctor, you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Go and throw yourself under a bus.
I didn't mean to say that. He told me to say that.
I'm Michelle.
I'm Chris.
And I'm SP from the Starling Tribune.
A podcast member of the Gonna Geek Network.
Just like the show you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of each individual host.
Check out all the other podcasts at GonnaGeek.com.
And get ready because geekiness begins in...
3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whitaker and beyond. Your GPR hosts are Jay Witten.
Safety measures are for chumps who don't know what they're doing.
Kier Hansen.
Oh, hold on. I saw it on my mixer. I turned up the suck. Hold on.
And Haley Malley.
I feel like I might need to carb up for next week's episode.
Oh, and...
spoilers.
We do discuss recent news, episodes that have already aired in their home territories, and the occasional interesting rumor. But don't worry, if we look too far into the future, we'll give you a fair warning. Welcome to episode 272 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where I'm all by myself. My name is Kier, and we are in the middle of the craze getting ourselves prepared for Gallifrey 1 coming up in just a matter of days here, but I would be remiss if we spent a week without having something to provide for everybody. So we're dipping into our con archives, speaking of Whovian conventions, and sharing a little snippet of a panel that we held at last year's Regeneration Who in Baltimore, Regen 3, I guess if you want to categorize it as such. We had the opportunity to sit down and talk about the possibility of Chris Chibnall and company coming into the production process for Series 11, and the rumor that had been going around that they were considering an American-style writer's room. Figured I wanted to have a couple of educated pundits to discuss the topic. Some names that you'll be familiar with from here on GPR. I was joined on the panel by Don Cleese of Acorn Media and Ian McCann, who runs Casual Nexus and a couple of other Whovian blogs and writing outlets, as well as a name you might be familiar with, Robert Shearman, writer for Doctor Who Time Immemorial. You also know him as the script writer for Dalek from the first season in 2005. A very interesting discussion. Didn't want to share the thing in its entirety to give you something to look forward to as we are coming up on Gallifrey 1, the 29th voyage, as it were, as well as Regeneration Who 4, which is coming up in just another month's time. So a little something to wet your whistle, and hope you enjoy.
I hope everyone has been having a phenomenal regen at this point, and will continue to. You are about at the midway point, so hope you're pacing yourself. My name is Kier Hansen. I'm the host of a couple of podcasts in the area here. One is called Gallifrey Public Radio.
Yay!
Very fond of that one. It's kind of near and dear to me. And the other is actually one that's not necessarily within the Whovian scope, but it does have to do with fandoms in general, called In Defense Of, where we come to the rescue of sidelined, marginalized, or lesser understood aspects of various fandoms so that we can hopefully break down some of the barriers of ignorance that tend to lead to some outside. But we are here today to discuss a possible, and I will hang that asterisk out there, hang my asterisk out there, return to a writer's room format. I should say return to.
It's never been done.
That absolutely. Yeah. Well, say to what we would be more familiar with here in the States, that has not really been utilized within UK. Oh, hold on, my mom's calling. Okay.
Isn't the Doctor Who theme? Shame on you.
that has been floated as a possible format that Chris Chibnall may be using for Series 11 of our show proper. So I wanted to get some folks together who have strong opinions on the matter. And I'll let them introduce themselves, starting down at the end with Mr. Cleese.
Yeah, my name is Don Cleese. I am the Vice President of Programming for Acorn TV, which means that I read scripts and watch British television for a living.
Good for you.
Yeah. Dream job.
Yes, it's, yeah. We let him off, it's because we feel sorry for him. His job is so terrible. Really. I'm an actor, I'm a writer, I have a blog called The Casual Nexus, where I do lots of fanny type things on it.
Fanny thing.
Oh god, I forget there's British here.
It means different things.
Yes. Anyway, you threw me off, how dare you. And been a tattoo fan for an embarrassingly long time. So I can talk.
My name's Rob, I'm a writer, I wrote for the... Hello, I'm going to wave. I wrote for the show back with Chris Eccleston, which was not a writer's room format, and I've written for Big Finish sometimes. And I write books and all sorts of nonsense. And I'm also a big Doctor Who fan, but, and a bigger Doctor Who fan than Ian. Even though I don't know that's actually true, I'm going to maintain it. Because
he's probably been doing it a bit longer.
Because I'm much, much, much older than Ian.
Yes.
So that's my...
Ancient.
Well,
weathered.
Venerable.
Weathered is true.
Venerable.
Seasoned. And sad now, actually, quite sad and changed.
He is sad.
Yeah.
Well, as I mentioned at the outset here, one of the reasons why this panel is in place in the first place is because back around May of last year, there was a story floated by the Radio Times and then got sort of echoed and signal boosted that Chibnall was considering the utilization of a U.S. stylized writer's room format for the structure of what he would assemble for Series 11. For those of you who may not be terribly familiar with how that functions, it allows for... Well, I'm not even going to give it a proper description. We're going to sort of see as that unpacks when we do a little bit of a pro-con analysis of how that could play. So, Robert, could you give us a little bit of a background of what the status quo currently is with regards to how the showrunner goes forward and says...
Right. I know it kind of varies. I mean, I worked with Stephen briefly on Series 5. It didn't actually end up being a script. I worked with Russell on Series 1. What they generally will do is that the showrunner will come to a writer and they'll give possibly a sentence or two as a starting point for what they want. Often tonal. So when I did Dalek in Series 1, it was very much, this will be Episode 6. It's going to be the contrast to a light comedy two-parter featuring the Slovene. Your story will be darker. It will be more action-packed. It brings back the Daleks. It has to contrast with what's been before. But the actual terms of what the story is basically left up to the writer at that point. I mean, you will then go through a process where you write your possibly synopsis. I didn't do that for draft for Dalek. I did more for Stephen when I worked with the Matt Smith one. And what you do at that point is you will then do a script. And at that point, the BBC, usually via the actual showrunner, because that is the lead writer in Doctor Who's instance, will then go backwards and forwards with you over a period of drafts, which you write, in which he gives you quite detailed notes. And it can be, as it was on Dalek, a complete change from what I originally had in mind. So what you end up with on screen is a synthesis of the writer's own writing, coupled with elements which might have been, I think particularly happened a lot with Russell and later Stephen episodes, where there's a script polish done by the showrunner, mixed in with the original kind of idea for what the episode tonally should be, but still with the writer's own storyline.
Okay.
So it's a weird mix, actually. It's very, very hard sometimes to work out quite how much of the spine comes from one single
story. Because I was about to ask, I mean, how much of it, or how much intervention, I should say, was really there as far as giving you the underpinnings, giving you the it's almost as if you take a program we know is almost completely improvised, or something like Curb Your Enthusiasm, where they have very, very rough skeleton of, we have to get our scenes from here to here to here, but anything that's going to evolve can be completely organic in the midstream.
Yeah.
But if you've got even less than that, you're given a tone.
Yeah, I mean, it was, on Dalek, it was actually remarkably straightforward, because I'd worked, my previous TV show, actually, ironically, been working with Chris Chibnall on a show called Born and Bred, where you actually were following also a loose story of, there was a sort of story throughout the season involving the main characters. And because that was a show in which you had effectively 10 main characters leaving room, who were there for every week,
right,
leaving room for you to have two guest characters, which would mean, therefore, that ongoing story was terribly important for the way the season was going. Whereas Doctor Who's joy is that you are given two main characters and at least, you know, or possibly three, and the rest of the cast are entirely your own creation. And of course that's, because it is largely character influence, that is terribly important.
Okay.
So on Dalek, I was told, introduce Adam, who I knew would be leaving in the next episode. Mm-hmm. But basically I was just told, I'd written for Big Finish a story called Jubilee, which had one single Dalek in it. And that's why Russell commissioned me. And he said, we don't want Jubilee, because that would be crazy, because it's a very, very dark, very, very, I think, inaccessible family episode. But he said, we'd love the idea of bringing back the Daleks via one single Dalek. How you want to do it is entirely up to you, but I suggest an underground base from a collector in Utah, and that was all I was given. So from that point on, you're kind of left, you're sort of thrown in the deep end and left to actually try and invent a story.
Okay.
And that's actually rather good, because it means that what you do is you have something that you actually want to say. Mm-hmm. Part of the danger sometimes, I think, of certain forms of writing, often on things like soap operas, is that you're hanging words upon other people's storylines and points, and you have to try and find as a writer a reason for why you're writing it. If it's your own story, then that is your reason. The reason is because it's something which you actively care about.
Okay.
So,
well, Don, I wanted to pick your brain on this as well, because there's as far as looking within the nature of bridge programming in general, in terms of, especially with dramatic series or action-oriented series where you may or may not have genuine concerns about continuity.
Right.
Throughout.
Well, you know, it's funny, when we're talking about doing this panel, the funny thing with Doctor, in most British shows, most British drama series, are very, this probably isn't a proper term, but I'm going to say author. You know, it's usually one person who is, you know, they are writing that series. They have been commissioned by the BBC or ITV or whoever to do this series. And Doctor Who has always been kind of a weird hybrid of that, somewhere between those continuing dramas like, you know, Coronation Street or something that go on forever and ever, mm-hmm. and these very highly authored shows. You know, Doctor Who has been highly authored in bursts, and, you know, now the show is much sort of, it's still a strange hybrid. I think I may be one of the only people who thinks that this sort of, Aldous talking about writer's room, it's like, well, it's almost just a twist from where the show is now, in a sense, because it is this one person saying, the show's going to go from, you know, A to Z over the course of a season, mm-hmm. or several seasons if you're Stephen Moffat. And, you know, and it's really about finding the writers who are going to kind of add the texture to it, for lack of a better term, you know. It's, you know, certainly looking at it, you know, in a drama, you know, you're having sort of six-part drama series, you know. You know, I got to read, you know, one of a script that Russell T. Davis is developing for a you know, mini series, and it's taking place over many years. And that's something I know. It's like, you know, A to Z is just going to be, you know, this vision. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, again, if I'm reading a potential new, you know, crime drama, I know that you know, the reset button is going to be hit, you know, in a sense. I mean, you're not worried about the characters. It's about, you know, it's the crime, not the characters. You know, and I don't ever foresee a situation where Doctor Who isn't going to be that kind of, you know, God, I'm using this word a lot, hybrid, you know, because it almost can't be anything else, because you need to say, here's our direction, mm-hmm. and then again, it's plugging writers in to do, you know, what they do. I mean, you know, what you did is obviously was not what Paul Cornell would have done, and vice versa, you know.
Right. And Muscle Bay specifically, I think, tailored that first season to play into our strengths. So you get people like Mark Gatiss, who was the first non-Russell writer out of the stable, and he was given The Unquiet Dead. But he was given Charles Dickens, because Mark's a massive Dickens fan, and told to make it like a sort of comedy horror, and that's Mark's thing. Mm-hmm. You know, and so Father's Day, I mean, I remember when I got the brief for the series one thing, which was, again, a few sentences per episode, and I read the Father's Day thing. It was so obviously for Paul Cornell, mm-hmm. but I wished it was mine, because I thought, I'd have to try that one myself. But I knew that Dalek was going to be my one. So,
but that's also, you know, again, this whole idea of authorship in Doctor Who. I was on a panel last night, and I said, I mean, I hold that season, that first season with Eccleston, I honestly, God, hold that up there with stuff like I, Claudius, as far as, like, top British dramas, because Yeah.
You're a very kind man.
don't ask my kids if that's true. But as far as something that's authored, I mean, a piece that very clearly, you know, from where you start with Rose to where you end up with Parting of the Ways, I mean, that is, as you know, again, with five writers kind of adding to their vision, it could not be more sort of.
It's kind of accidental, though. That's what's so weird about it. I mean, I remember.
And then it's very Doctor Who, because Doctor Who's all about happy accidents.
I think what was funny about that first series was that, I mean, again, having worked with Chris very recently, just before that, where all the writers would never meet, because we were kept apart from each other, because, in fact, in some ways, you actually almost feared the other writers, because you felt that if you got sacked, they'd get your job. Mm. And on Doctor Who, we weren't ever brought together by the BBC, but we were all friends.
Right.
So I mean, we never met up more than once, I think, Mark, Stephen, Paul and I all together. I mean, I saw Mark and Stephen quite frequently. Paul lived in Oxford, so I didn't see him so often.
Right.
But we would, because I think we were all so scared, I think that's okay to say that now.
Sure.
I mean, we were terrified, actually, we were massive Doctor Who fans, given this charge of bringing back a show that we dearly loved, and we thought that we might kill it forever. We thought, if we did this wrong, everyone across the world who loved Doctor Who, you guys, would forever hate us. And it made us very nervous, and so we would use each other as a sort of support group. Mm. And we'd send each other privately drafts we were doing, but normally that isn't what happens. I mean, it was right.
So you created an informal writer's room, basically.
Yes.
In the first year.
Yeah.
So the first year's invalid, you had to scratch that off.
And yet it was that funny thing also, that it was, and yet we would often not try to influence each other with script so much, because we also knew that, I mean, I knew that the way I was writing, for example, Chris Eccleston's Doctor was not the way that Mark was writing him or Paul was, and I was being pushed more and more in a direction by the controlling influence of Russell and Julie, mm-hmm. to make him harder and more opposite to what they were doing. So in some ways, it felt a bit at times like you were being controlled by this master chef who wasn't telling you how he was stirring the other ingredients.
Okay.
And that we were concerned that we would be mucking up the ingredients if we talked too much about certain things. It was a very, very strange time.
It begs the question, I think, we need to answer it. Is Doctor Who, in its current form, a plot-driven show or a character-driven show?
It has changed a lot.
Because writer's room and individualist writers work better for the different types of that.
It's true.
If you're plot-driven, writer's room is a pretty good way to go, to be honest. But individual or character writers, it's great.
Yes, that's right. And it's also very, very good for comedy. Right?
Yes.
It's not usually quite so good for straight individual dramas.
Yes.
Because, and of course, Doctor Who is, it's basically for all that we pretend, and all that the new series also pretends, it's an ongoing narrative.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the Twilight Zone. It's actually an anthology series.
Yes.
And there's really no point in the writer's room setup with the writer of episode 7 interfering with episode 2 on a different
And I do think the different writers work for that variety.
Yeah, that's right.
Different styles,
that's right.
And different tones and messages and variety. And you know, you when you get tropes and when you write stuff, people, you have certain tropes that you have, people go,
I
associate some, whether you do or not.
I am totally trope-free.
Yes. What about tripe?
I'm not tripe-free. I put lots of tripe in my episode.
Not after last night's dinner.
No, you're right. I mean, the thing is that you can always tell, and we could tell very, very quickly what the Stephen Moffat type episodes were going to be. You know, in the same way we could tell what Mark's stuff was going to be.
Sure. And that's kind of nice.
It is
but
nice.
But it's very individual to the UK style television, though.
Yes, it is. Yes. That's right.
I mean, can you point out most writers in American television? I mean, don't all name Joss Whedon at once.
Futurama, which has a writer's room, has 26, I believe, the last time I checked.
Mm. Yeah.
26. I mean, any of your type of sitcoms, can you name people off the writer's room? Unless you're like an Uber fan?
But
Modern Family.
Yeah, but
absolutely.
Yeah. But of course, these are also the actual showrunner types who are coordinating.
Yes, yeah.
The thing about, see, most television works upon the idea of trying to persuade the viewer that all of this is narratively the same voice. And Doctor Who is one of the few programmes out there which deliberately tries to make you feel the opposite.
Mm.
It actually tries to say, this is nothing like last week, and it feels different, and it seems like a different writer. And it was the reason we had such problems back in 2005. Selling it to the States, because and I'm sure I'm not speaking out of tone too much. I mean, Russell says something on the lines of that when they try to sell it to American networks, the word came back and said, "Are you incompetent?" It's like every episode is a completely different series, and it's all and it has a completely different tone of style of writing. What? That's not how television even works. I mean, and therefore, American Network wouldn't buy it.
For I don't think it caught on in this country.
Because they couldn't see what on earth we were playing at. How, you know, we would go from, for example, my episode would be following on from that farting Slovene story, and people would say, "Well, that's not even remotely tonally the same." And in Wales, we'd be saying, "Yeah, it's completely different." And that's not the way TV should be. TV's meant to be. If you watch The West Wing or The Newsroom with Aaron Sorkin, you're meant to see this as being actually tonally the same because that's what makes it good. Mm-hmm. Even though other writers have been writing other parts of it. But we were trying actually to cause more fractures.
Yes, being tonally the same is the work for Doctor Who. Yeah.
No, that's
it's
right.
Bread and butter is variety and difference and unexpected.
I think it only falls into problems, and it has happened in the new series a bit, where it feels a bit tonally the same because a showrunner might be imposing too much. I mean, I think that one of Russell's...
Arcs of the plot.
I think Russell's genius, in part, was that Russell has such a tremendous variety of writing tone. You could go through watching the Dr. Donna season, and although Russell actually had been, by that stage, was rewriting quite a lot of the series, you don't feel that you're watching the same show every week. Okay. Whereas there is, a danger with some of Stephen's stuff, and I love Stephen's writing, but you can actually identify quite a lot that this is a very, very Stephen-ish thing every week, and that's when it begins
definitely
to get a bit
same. It's time on the show.
It has. You almost have that desire for that sort of rep theatre versatility.
Absolutely.
Which is kind of why it's going to be interesting. Having the conversation now is rather tricky, so I'm giving us a difficult topic to try and dissolve, because
thanks,
of the fact that we have to... You're welcome. We have to determine where the story defines itself at the close of a season we have yet to see. So if Stephen wants a swan song, and he wants to watch the world burn and leave us gutted, as you know he's going to do.
Well, you say that.
Well, I'll put a fiver down on that one.
Okay.
Or has the opportunity, the motive and such to do it. I'm accusing him before he does it, but he's got the motive, the
that's
opportunity.
That's never stopped,
man. Yeah. Then that means that Chris steps into this, with the opportunity to do either thing. He could say, you know what, I want to get back to versatility, I want this to be a variety base, I want it to be a something for everyone and everything for no one.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to go full Broadchurch with this, and I have a path, an agenda, a storyline, a character set, and a team that I'm going to be over like a hawk to see this story told, because this is my opportunity now to share with you what the show means or what the franchise means to me.
Sure.
Have you, with the work you've done with Chris, does he strike you as the type who plays the long game?
Not necessarily. I think that Chris wants to... I'm not speaking to Chris in a little while. I'm not one of the writers that will be on season 11.
You're first, but...
But Chris is actually a very, very open writer, and I think that he's a very, very emotional writer. I think that's one of the joys of what he does at its best. I don't see him... I don't see him tying the show into complicated arcs so much. I see it as probably it to be more character-based, but I think also to be more family-based probably than what Stephen's been doing.
So you're saying lighter?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying different tone. I think that... I don't know, to be honest, but I don't see him actually... See, that's why the writer's room thing confuses me. I don't see Chris as the sort of writer who will be an Aaron Sorkin, who will be a very, very controlling influence.
Right, very
good.
Just as so.
I think that he will want to just... I think because he's the reason that Chris is there, in part, is because the BBC were terribly keen to get a writer on board showrunning who had experience showrunning here in the States. That was a big attraction for him. And Chris had done Camelot, and he'd done Grace Point. And so he came, and so that was a, that was one of the huge attractions. But I think that that writer's room thing was, in some ways, I think it was probably speculation about what Chris might do. I don't think Chris necessarily fully knows himself yet. And every writer who's taken over, it was the same with Russell and same with Stephen, they will go into the job, and a year or so down the line, they will say over a pint to us that everything they thought they knew about how they would control the writing style doesn't work. Stephen, when Stephen took over, he said to me, you know, he said, I don't understand quite why Russell makes it so hard. I mean, all you have to do is just call up a bunch of really, really good writers and let them write their scripts, and why doesn't that work? And so that's why he called up Richard Curtis and Neil Gaiman and Simon Nye and a few others. I mean, Paul and I were contacted as well. And he said, how about, you know, it could be really easy, this job. And about a few months in, he was giving me a phone call and saying, it's like I'm in charge of this 13-carriage train, and I'm responsible for carriage number 2, and that's going okay, but I'm not sure what's going on. But carriage number 7 doesn't exist, and carriage number 8 is on fire. Carriage 12 now can't work because carriage 8 is on fire, and carriage 9 doesn't seem to, they haven't started building it yet, even though
we're so in season 5. Anyone remember?
So it ends up being the sort of situation where he said, I now get it, that, and also getting really good writers on board who don't get Doctor Who, it's a completely different form of writing. I mean, Richard Curtis was a good example. You know, he wanted Vincent and the Doctor, but Stephen had to rewrite an awful lot of Vincent to make it
a Doctor
actually
Who
Doctor Who.
It seems like that's what's always happened with the show, though. I mean, every script editor who's taught from like the original run of the show, it seems like when they've talked about it, it's talked about how difficult
but
it was.
It's also part of the thing, which is also true for Chris. I mean, but not as true actually. That Russell and Stephen, when they took over Doctor Who, had largely been the sort of writers who were in charge of their own authorial vision as the only author on their shows. So when Russell, I remember the very first meeting with Russell, and he sat me down, and he'd done the same speech to all of us, I think earlier that day, and he said, I want this to be a writer-led show, and I want you to have your episode, you do whatever you want, and if you ever have any problems with what we're doing, you tell us and we'll stop it. And I thought, as he told me that, that's never going to work, but what a wonderful thing to try. And about a few months down the road, he was saying, yeah, obviously you don't have that power at all. But he genuinely meant it. And I think Stephen meant the same thing, because they had come at it as authors. Mm-hmm. Whereas on Born and Bred, the real bosses on Born and Bred, my Chris Chibnall show, were the exec producers, who weren't writers at all, and treat you a bit like cattle. Mm-hmm. But Russell and Stephen love writers because they are writers. And Chris too. Chris has come through a phase, actually, where he's now been running shows which have been written by other authors. So in some ways, he's the most experienced of all of them. Okay. About how he will corral the writers on board. I don't know how it's going to be yet. I mean, Broadchurch, I think, is single author, isn't it? So it's
him.
Yeah, the whole thing's him. And I think that's how every writer prefers to write. But, and I think that Russell had that choice on Series 1. I think that the BBC came to him and said, we can offer you a guaranteed 2-season show of 6 episodes each, and you write all of them. Or you can, and Russell said, I don't think Doctor Who is a show written by one author, and I want to go for 13 episode season, like the old days, you know, the same length. And they said, if you do that, you're putting all your eggs into one basket. If it doesn't work, it will never come back. And Russell said, but it's meant to be written by more than me, and that's why it's the way it is now.
Okay.
Because it could have all just been Russell, and I think that's what the BBC probably wanted at the beginning, because that seems the most obvious thing to commission it for.
Yeah.
Well, looking to see what the audience has sort of cultivated to come to expect at this point now as well. We are coming off the back end of a deliberate intent to increase the weight and the heftiness of the dramatic elements to the program. So. Yeah. There was conscious effort to try and, by either making a long succession of two-parters, or carrying the arcs a little farther and going a little darker, or at least making everything a little more weighty, that there was an intent to try and show how heavy we could go and still be consumable.
Yeah.
But we also have, and I'm getting way off of our original point of the conversation, but we have to recognize the fact that the audience is far more global than it has ever been in its entirety, and is less British-viewed. than it has been in quite some time.
Even in Britain? Yeah.
Within Britain proper. Yeah.
Show used to get 12 million people at its
Well,
peak.
Very well, once. I mean, Voyager would have damned it very well.
8 million, 7 million was routine.
Right. Well, yeah. The reason why I mention this, though, is because there has to be, from an executive level, from the BBC's standpoint, as a business, and recognizing this as a money-making opportunity, that they have to start to recognize the individuals they are handing the reins to and the content that they are going to be putting in front of the viewing audience has to recognize who that audience truly is, even if that means changing the tonality of the series as a whole, or leaning towards writers, script editors, executive producers, who are going to say, you know what, we're really going to have to do more to appease the Americans and the Australians because they.
I don't think anybody at the BBC is going to say that whatsoever.
Yeah, I think
BBC packs taxpayer money.
Yeah,
Stephen himself will say, no, we're not going to be Americans. I think it's a British show. People like it because it's British.
Right. I mean, I think one of the things to keep in mind here, you know, we sort of talk about the BBC as this, you know, kind of monolithic entity, but. You know, but you've got the BBC, which, you know, the publicly funded British broadcaster, who actually makes it, commissions the show, and all that. And then BBC Worldwide, whose job it is to sell it around the world and merchandising and all those things. And you know, I'm sure that the people from BBC Worldwide, you know, have the ear of the people making the show. But at the end of the day, it does have that. You know, getting good viewership and popularity around the world is a help, but at the end of the day, it has to work for the British audience. The BBC won't keep doing it if it doesn't work for the British audience, at least on some reasonable level.
Yeah, and the BBC, BBC actually has several different companies, and they're often, frankly, at war with each other. It's quite odd, working with them sometimes. I think that no one's concerned at the BBC about the ratings, particularly for Doctor Who. BBC Worldwide, I suspect, and I don't really know this for certain, but I think have noticed probably over the period of the Capaldi regime that it's not selling merchandise in quite the bulk it was for Matt, because Peter is older, and I suspect that they would rather like a more marketable Doctor for that, but that isn't actually going to interfere with what the decisions are made by the people who make the programme, because they won't allow that to be a problem. The Russell's take was always when we couldn't sell it to America in Series 1. He said, but it's not for them. It has to be, our commission brief is that we are doing this for the people who are paying the license fee in Britain. And anything that we do externally has to always be a very, very happy knock-on effect. And I don't actually honestly think that they can afford to take those global concerns too much into consideration artistically.
Okay.
Because it causes problems, actually.
And just to backtrack on the show's appeal in this country, people like it being very British.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is the quintessential Britishness of the show is the appeal of the world around them. If you start throwing in, American companions,
There's an expression.
You can have trouble with.
There's an expression, I heard this at a conference I was at several years ago. It was about nonfiction television, but I think it holds true. The concept of co-production sludge, where you've got a program that's being funded by this broadcast from Japan, this broadcast from Germany. It's a thing about World War II. You've got to do something that won't offend Germany, and it won't offend Japan, and it won't offend the British audience, and you end up doing something, you end up so busy trying not to offend a particular constituency that you don't actually give them a reason to watch.
Right. You've rounded the corners in the entire
country. Yeah, so I think that element of trying to please this, theoretical global audience, that you don't actually know who they are at any one point, versus pleasing the audience, the audience, again, the BBC, 6 o'clock on a Saturday night audience.
I mean, it's true. I mean, the basic reason why they first asked Russell, then Stephen, and now Chris to do it is that they want a person in charge who doesn't feel like they're part of a BBC production process like it was in the old days, where you would inherit a producer would be assigned Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. They want people who are proper authors that they believe have their own artistic vision, and they want them actually to be free to pursue that. So, I mean, the excitement, I think, for Chris is that Chris is his is his own man. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't try and inhibit him in any way about saying, but we want you to be aware that there's that market there and that market there.
Okay.
I think the attraction, again, as I say, for Chris, was that he'd done American shows. But I think that's because they found the excitement there about there might be a new system, that he might have learned other methods of show running.
Okay.
Well, do we know that we're going to get a writer's room, or is it just speculation?
It's speculation.
It's still speculation.
Okay, so no one's... Okay.
But it got me kind of wondering. I mean, we can very quickly identify some of the issues with that approach, both stylistically. There's the logistics,
yes,
obviously, that are of a you know, pretty substantial concern.
Yeah.
There's a cost association.
It's very expensive.
And yeah, and we know that the purse strings are not exactly, you know, flapping in the wind, so they're pulled pretty taut. Are there though, can anyone argue that there are potential advantages to that approach with this program, where it stands or where it's headed at this point in time?
Yes.
If you pick the right group of writers.
Well, that's always good.
Yeah, I mean, but I think you need, you know, you almost have to you almost have to have a group of writers who foster not exactly conflict, but, you know, healthy tension. You know, because I think, to one of the points Rob made about tone, it is a show that thrives on difference. And again, you can't have, pardon the expression, a room full of Stephen Moffats or a room full of Mark Gatisses.
Oh God, can you imagine?
You know, because obviously I know the
20 of them. Yeah, all
the physics of it are obviously.
Yeah. Are you clever? I'm clever too.
Well, like he was saying about arcs, it depends on what Chris wants. If Chris wants to go and have it be arc-heavy, having a writer's room would be really good for that.
Absolutely.
It really just depends. But if he wants it to be every episode is something new, it's like back in the old days of Tom Baker, you never know what's going to happen next, writer's room isn't really going to help you much.
No.
It's going to be chaos.
In fairness, you knew somebody was going to be possessed by something.
Yeah.
And it's going to be Leela because, you know, she was a cat.
I do think, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I do think that not a writer's room where they're all in one place, but that the email network that you guys have,
the occasional
is useful for, not to, Ian made a very good point where it's really useful, but the other thing is the showrunner being the Lord thy God who will give thee thy storyline. Can put, if the writers are all talking to each other, they can push back on that and say, you know what would be better would be this. Or, you know, they can collaborate a bit more.
Sure. I think you should always do the informal, to be really entirely honest. But I don't think actually throwing people and specifically saying you think really works. But I think you guys should have some sort of vague knowledge of what the other's doing, because in the end you are going to be watching the season as a whole.
There's been a point trying to be made for ages. Which I think
the chair recognizes
have.
Will.
Yes.
Thank you. About Doctor Who's appeal outside of Britain, would I be correct in saying that that basically the people who pay the taxes that fund the BBC are the main concern, and anything else is an afterthought, like making sure that it appeals to them is never thought. But isn't that sort of BBC world? Isn't that most of the job of BBC worldwide?
Yeah, exactly.
They're the ones who care about Australia, Germany, the US, and everywhere else. The BBC is making sure that, one, there's material for Britain, and two, there's material for BBC worldwide.
Yeah, it's exactly right. I mean, it's a very, very complicated problem, because the BBC, technically, because it's funded by the British public, isn't allowed to be exactly a commercial organisation and make money except by accident, which means BBC Worldwide exists kind of accidentally, and therefore you can do it, and of course they will, and they'll want to make their money, but they're not meant to be doing it deliberately, which is very, very silly.
But it used to be in the charter that they weren't allowed to make profit, right?
Yeah, that's right. So BBC Worldwide is very, very important, but they're not allowed, therefore, to dictate content. So, for example, a few years ago, and I think this is true, BBC Worldwide were very alarmed that there was an entire season which seemed to have no monsters in it, because it was getting a little bit more psychological. And they said, can we have some monsters? Because it would actually help sell a few toys. And they said, we forgot about that. Sorry, we'll put some monsters back in. So the conversations can go on, but they can't dictate policy in that way. So it is difficult, because if it were being made just purely to make money, to try and make maximum sales elsewhere, Doctor Who wouldn't be the sort of programme it is anyway. It's one of the reasons actually why it's quite fun to work on, because you go into it rather pretentiously as if you're an artist, and you think, yes, I am a deeply serious writer who's writing about a police box and pepper pots. But actually you're allowed to do that because you're not worrying about people on the networks who have to fund for advertising, because we have no advertising, because we don't have commercial breaks. It's all about, therefore, making it the best episode you can and having a blind eye to the fact that this is also going to probably have to sell in other regions as well.
But it's not your job as the writer to do that. You should be there sitting there thinking, oh God, what are they going to think in Australia about this character?
And yet, technically, of course, you do think that, because you don't, as a writer, you don't go out there. I mean, you like to pretend as a writer.
But no one's going to go up to you and say, you know, do that.
You like to pretend as a writer that you are writing only ever for yourself. But if you do that, you often produce things which only you enjoy, and no one actually else wants to read or put on. So you've got that sort of, always that sort of double think. So the same thing is always happening with Doctor Who.
Well, it's the great irony of Doctor Who. I mean, it's the show that only the BBC would ever make, but they're also sort of the least qualified to kind of put it out in the world. Which is sort of the joy of it.
It's also partly because it was created not by a BBC guy. Back in the 60s, it was done by Sidney Newman, who came from the ABC. And was seen by the BBC people at the time, always rather stuffy, pipe-smoking 1960s men, as being, he seems like a very, very horribly commercial man. And what's this Doctor Who programme he's got? That sounds like it might actually be rather good fun. We're not sure we want it to be fun. And of course, Doctor Who has always therefore written that strange line about it being, you know, the idea of it being a sort of educational programme that no one would enjoy very much was kind of how the BBC wanted it to be for a while.
There was a really funny article I remember from probably when I was about Will's age, imagining what an American network executive would have said to the sort of the pitch for Doctor Who. And it was so funny to read.
It's nonsense.
Right. It would be like, well, wait, we don't like the long hair because that's like a symbol of rebellion. And it's like, a phone box, I mean, couldn't we have something that looks a little more like a traditional spaceship? And again, it really should, you know, Doctor Who just shouldn't work, it does.
Mm-hmm. I mean, part of the thing, I mean, when I was, you know, other shows I've worked on, they give you series Bibles. That's a very, very American thing.
Right.
And you arrive on a show and they give you the series Bible, which is about that. You know, it's that thick. It's longer than War and Peace. Mm-hmm. And it tells you stuff which has been done and what they want to do. When I arrived from Doctor Who, they gave me the series Bible. Russell said, I mean, I have to give you a series Bible. Ooh, amazing, a series Bible. And it was two sheets of paper. Russell said, I find it hard to cut it out to that length. You know, it's telling you time and space to have adventures.
So there you have it. A little snippet, taste of the conversations that we have at conventions like this. And always an absolute pleasure speaking with Don, with Ian, and of course with Robert Shearman. An absolute delight and an asset to any panel. It's just a wealth of information. So hopefully this has you your appetite piqued to head over to Gallifrey One if you're going to be seeing us in L.A. If you're not going to join us in L.A., hopefully you'll see us at Regeneration Who in Baltimore coming up in a month's time. If we're not going to see you there, we'll see you at another convention coming down the pike, because we're right in the middle of our season here. So looking forward to that. When we convene for next week, we'll obviously be live from the Gallifrey One floor. Haley and I have a lot of news to cover, as well as all the sights and sounds and opportunities to speak with the folks that we see there. So until then, this is Keir saying thank you and allons-y.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.